an American icon who fought in World War II, gave you Martin Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All's Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, a.k.a. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704 Hauser, Channel Umpteen and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. No matter who you are, no matter what you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
This is Norman Lear speaking of titles. I like All of the Above because it suggests that maybe we're going to cover a reasonable amount of All of the Above.
Or literally all of the above.
So that was Paul Hipp who just said that. This is Norman Lear, and we are talking about All of the Above. And we have with us today a glorious visitor. A most beautiful and glorious visitor. Now, we can't say that every day because
you
can't speak of guys as being beautiful.
Well, Antonio Banderas is awfully handsome.
No, he was handsome.
Yeah, but not as beautiful as our guest today.
No. And when she came in, she was wearing this glorious purple. Is it purple? Reddish purple. This glorious hat.
Wait, she's here already? We're not doing the imaginary entrance?
Yes. No.
Oh, okay, yeah.
No, she was here, and then she had to leave because you weren't here.
Oh, so that's right.
She was waiting for you to...
One of the great,
you
great
would think
talents.
We are because we're so foolish, covering all of the above.
Absolutely.
It is ridiculous. There she comes.
She's here she comes. I can hear her laughing down the hallway.
Yes, yes. You know, let's see how many people recognize her initials. JL. Folk?
Ladies and gentlemen. JL.
Do you hear all those people screaming Judith Light?
Yeah, I heard it. Huh? I can hear it. Listen. Yeah, Judith, welcome.
Hello, hi, Judith. Hello, gentlemen, caller friends. Hello.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here. Very happy to see you.
There is nobody I know of in our business busier than you.
You.
You. So how do you – I so treasure that you found the time to come here.
When I knew it was you, I really – I'm only here for a couple of days, and so I really wanted to work it out. I really wanted to see you.
Are you – can it be said of you that you're living in the East now?
It can be said of me that I am bicoastal. That is what I do.
Uh-huh.
You know, I have a husband here and in Los Angeles, and he thinks that I should come and see him every once in a while, and I agree with him. And so that's...
I agree with him, too.
Of course
that's
you
crazy.
Do. Yeah, it's pretty fabulous.
That's crazy.
I have to say it works wonderfully well. So I have to say, it really does.
Too happy. So you're in New York, he's here.
Right.
And then you see each other.
Well, I come back here. I've been flying back and forth. I fly back and forth like every 10 days. And so, but when I'm doing a show in New York... Do you know that this man that you're sitting next to, Mr. Norman Lear, has seen everything that I have done in the theater? He comes to everything. I am so moved and so touched by this man.
That's because
You're amazing. You're amazing. So anyway, so when I do a play, Norman comes to see me, and then my husband comes in, and he's there for like 10 days, and then he'll come back to California, and then I come back when I'm free. And so we go back and forth. And
taking turns flying.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you love the theater as I do, I don't know. You know, when I was a kid living in Hartford, Connecticut, I used to work, you know, I was a good humor man when I was able to drive, and before that I sold magazines. I did what I had to do in order to afford to get on the New York on a Saturday morning, go to New York. My folks let me do this when I was 15 years old. Go to New York, see a show, a matinee, and come back on Saturday.
That's great.
The greatest.
Put that love of theater together with the love of Judith Light. And
that's a lot of love.
Have you got something
that's a lot
fabulous
to love.
Or what?
Yeah, there's a lot to love there.
Thanks.
So that explains why I happen to have seen.
There he is. I did a one-woman show last two about a year and a half ago, down at the Lucille Ortel Theater in, as our people would say, in Yenenveld. Down there he was.
Can't Do you know
the Lucille, or
what that word means in my life?
No.
Yenenveld?
No.
Listen to what you happened on. 100 years ago, many years ago, a fellow who, do you know this?
Yeah, I love
a
this.
A fellow who owned Caesar's Palace. I was friendly with him. He owned it for 3 years. I was friendly with him. He said to me one day, Norman, you know, we have two homes, one in La Costa, one in Palm Springs. They're 5 bedrooms each. They're fully staffed. They're basically for high rollers. But they're often empty. And why don't you call my office sometime and use one of them? So I called his office shortly thereafter. The one in Palm Springs was available on a weekend, Friday through Monday. So I invited Carl Reiner and Estelle, Mel Brooks and Annie,
oh, God.
Dom DeLuise and Carol,
God.
And Larry Gilbart and Pat.
How's that for a crew?
And Lears, 5 couples.
Oh my God.
And we went down and we spent a weekend. And then twice a year, or maybe a little more, but certainly twice a year, because we used each house for 6 or 7 years. We called ourselves, and it was Larry Gilbart's suggestion, Yenenveld.
Come on. Yeah.
Yes.
Come on.
And Larry wrote a song, which he was in his room writing. He came out, he handed everybody the lyrics. Yeah. On a piece of paper, and this is the song. Oh, Yenenveld. 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 Oh, Yenenveld, oh, Yenenveld, there is no veld like Yenenveld.
This is so brilliant. Not only that, I want to see that movie.
Oh.
That is a movie.
You guys probably didn't laugh too much during those weekends.
Oh, right? We laughed so much that there were some weekends that we got there Friday night, woke up, and had breakfast in our bedclothes, and put our regular clothes on at the end of the weekend, and stayed in our bedclothes for the whole day.
Oh my God!
Just laughing.
Don't you want to see that?
Yeah, absolutely.
That movie?
To have been a fly on
that wall. Yeah.
You want to see the 10 of us playing something we called Celebrity Grapefruit?
Stop.
How does one play?
Don't you love that he tickles himself? Fabulous. Celebrity Grapefruit?
Celebrity Grapefruit. We sat around in the pool. Still in bed. I remember us in sleep clothes. Tossing you never knew who was going to toss you the grapefruit, a single grapefruit. And somebody started a story. Every time you got the grapefruit, you had to add to the story.
Oh. With that crew?
Oh, come on.
Wow.
I mean, that's really... But the imagination of what you can think of with that group of people just beyond anything. I mean, talk about the brilliance and the creativity in that group.
Yeah.
Must have been just spectacular.
It was fabulous. We didn't know we were who... I mean, we didn't think about that.
Of course
we
not.
We just amused the
you
hell
were
out
your
of
friend,
each other.
And you were friends.
Yeah.
I mean, so you don't tend to think of it like that.
But the material that must have gone out into the ether with the grapefruit you guys threw that thing and added on to each other's
but
story.
But you're talking about energy.
Yeah.
And energy in the universe of people that find each other. And there's something about that ends up becoming incredibly magical.
Annie and Pat and Estelle had a little singing trio. I love the title. They called themselves the Mother Sisters. I don't know why that amuses me as much as it does, but I think of it 50 times a year, and it breaks me up.
The mother sisters. Yeah. It's just because it's clever.
So you woke up, yes, and did what else today, Judith?
What else did I do today? What did I do? I went to the chiropractor because, you know, when you fly a lot, you know, you need an adjustment. And then my husband asked me if I would pick up some things at the grocery store, which I did. And then I went to pick up the mail. And then I came to see you.
That was so picking up groceries. That's
so wifely.
Judith Light
shops for groceries.
Darling, yes. Wow. These are things one must do. Wow. I mean, and everybody's so lovely. It's nice to get out and see people and go and do. And,
yeah.
You know, there's nothing wrong with doing your own errands, you know.
Do you enjoy being recognized?
It's not the recognition. It's the connection.
Yeah.
It's the experience of talking to people who not only appreciate what you do, but how they interpret what you've done in their lives for them. And then when you have the chance to have those conversations, those dialogues with those people, it's so infinitely gratifying.
Yes.
So it's not the recognition, it's the connection that's made for me.
We go back to Who's the Boss.
We do. We do.
So that was what year that started, 82 or so?
Yeah. Well, we did it, the pilot was done in 83 and it went on the network 84. That's when it was Embassy TV.
Yeah.
Embassy TV. And Embassy. That's when you had Tuchasov and Tish. T-A-T.
T-A-T.
Tuchasov and Tish.
Yeah.
Right.
Do you know what that means?
Remind me.
Tuchasov and Tish means ass on the table.
Yeah.
T-A-T.
Yeah.
We had Embassy Tandem T-A-T.
Right. Uh-huh.
T-A-T stood for Tuchasov and Tish, which is a Yiddish expression for put your ass on the table.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
How many years did that season did that run?
So we did it and we went on the air in 84. It was made to be picked up. We shot it in September. They made it to be picked up for mid-season. And they didn't pick it up for mid-season because what they did was ABC tested it and it went through the roof. That's when Lou Ehrlich was at ABC.
Yes.
And it went through the roof. And they said, wait, we're not going to put it on for midseason. We're going to put it in with everything else for the fall. This is when they used to do things like that.
Yeah, right.
And they put it in for the fall. And they put us on Thursday night opposite the Cosby lineup. Well, we were dying. We were in the toilet. And so... And the numbers were so good that they kept switching us around. I mean, Norman knows this. They kept switching us around from night to night until they found the place where we could be, which was 8 o'clock on a Tuesday night, and that's how we came to be. And then we ran for 8 years.
That's classic.
It's truly it's a classic story, but. You know,
I didn't have a lot to do with Who's the Boss.
But you were there. I mean, you were part of that whole embassy thing.
I was there, but the show, I can't remember. Who were the writers?
The creators were Marty Cohen and Blake Hunter.
And Blake Hunter.
Yeah.
Danza, right? Tony
Danza. It's my Danza. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
The great ukulele player,
Ukulele player, and he plays Atlantic City now in Las Vegas and everything. He loves it.
It's the best. I would see him at Tavrona Tony's in Malibu with his ukulele out on the outdoor patio. Yeah. While you were dining, Tony would come over and play songs for you. Yeah, it was great.
So funny. He was a good guy. I learned a lot about comedy from him. He was really, very, very instrumental in my learning about comedy.
He is a love.
Such a sweet man.
He's a sweetheart. And has a real passion. He took ownership of that show. He said, I am going to make this be what I know everybody else wants it to be and what I see that it could be. And he had that vision and he was right on top of everything.
He learned a little bit from Judith Light also.
You know, I don't know. I think he would say maybe so, Norman, about there were things about what I learned from him about comic timing was invaluable. And I think what he learned from me was more about knowing the fact that I saw what a great actor he was. And I think that's something that it was a takeaway for him. Right. And he is. He's an extraordinary, extraordinarily fine actor. A natural, a total natural is a perfect way to describe him. Absolutely.
Where did you come across that? Where did you start your career? Because you have the ability to do comedy, drama, do it all. So obviously you've got the chops. Where did you acquire those other than natural talent?
You're so sweet. I think my parents gave me a lot. My parents were incredibly supportive. They saw something in me, and they fostered it.
That's an unusual tale.
Yeah.
I haven't heard that a lot.
Yeah, they
When they began to foster that in you, how old might you have been?
My father saw it in me when I was about 3 years old.
Wow, really?
Yeah, I was little. My mother had me, this is a story that I've told a lot. My mother had me memorize "Twas the Night Before Christmas." Vauden. "Twas the Night Before Christmas." So I did it for my father. And he was, I remember his face. And he was weeping at the end of it.
Oh, my.
And I just, everybody got it at that moment. It was one of those moments. And so...
And you were 3-4 years old.
I was, yeah.
And where are you growing up?
Trenton, New Jersey.
Trenton,
New Jersey. And so it was really important to them that I be educated. I'm an only child, and they felt that it was really important. And I agreed with them. I said, this is really important. So everything was done, anything that I did theatrically, community theater, anything like that, was all done around schoolwork.
Uh-huh.
And then when I had a really – I went to a girls' private school, and there was a drama teacher there, a wonderful woman named Ruth Strand, and she was also one of the people who was part of admissions. And she said, I think you should go to Carnegie Tech summer program, which has now become Carnegie Mellon University. Yes. And she said, I think you should go there for the summer and see how you feel about it. Great drama program. I went there for the summer, and I applied there for the fall, and I got in. And so it was about – for me, it was about going to college as well as studying acting at the same time, because I wanted to get a broader education as well. You know, I didn't want to just say, okay, this is all I'm ever going to do.
Right.
And you can't create a character of substance without having an expanded education. That's why I love your book so much, Norman. It's remarkable the level of work that you've done on yourself and the kinds of experiences that you have that have culminated in the kind of experience you have that you take out into the world. And I think that those of us that are in this business, it's our responsibility to do that. Mm. Otherwise, we're at a surface level of the way we work, and it doesn't really do...
Oh, that's a wonderful way to put it.
Yeah.
Who wants that?
Surface level of the way, as opposed to opening up.
Yeah.
All the way.
And going much deeper. You know, and relating to the world around you. I mean, look at what's happening in our world right now.
Yeah.
Look at what is happening, and we're. I don't want to make a doomsday prediction. That's not the way I hold the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we have – I was just talking to Norman about One Day at a Time and how important I think that show is, particularly in this climate.
One Day at a Time is the show we're doing, a Latino version of the show we did a great many years ago. And it's on Netflix starring Rita Moreno and Justina Machado, and it's
gorgeous.
I'm learning so much too, because despite the fact that my bumper sticker reads "Just another version of you," and I believe we have versions of each other, I've never lived with a Latin family before, and it's a Cuban American family, and I learned so much from Justina and from Rita and so forth.
Well, we learned stuff from watching it too. I mean, not everybody's educated about this life and what people are going through and what a woman returning from combat has to be dealing with.
Yeah.
It's remarkable. But it goes to the point that I was making about, will you go deep? How much will you expand? Is your career and it, if your career is your top note to me in your life, you're not living a life that's of great value to yourself or other people. It's if your life is your top note and your career comes under that heading, then you can make the kinds of changes and you can do the kind of work that Norman's done all through these years.
Yeah.
All
those different... the three of us have done.
We continue to gather raw materials, which for the artist is life, experience, knowledge, all of it. The entire everything is on our palette.
Right. And how? But how do you use that?
Yeah.
How do you put that aspect of what you're learning and how you're connecting and that we are just versions of each other? Yeah. How do we connect with each other in a way to open that up as another aspect of our lives?
How would you describe the way you do it as an actress?
I use everything. I read everything. I listen to everything. It's one of the reasons that I say that I love you so much is because you're an inspiration about the way you take life and hold life. And meeting people and getting information from them about how they've lived and what they've taken a hold of and what's inspired them, turned them on, electrified them, given them an experience of evolution and expansion. And that's what I want to do.
That's what you've been doing all these years.
But I think, but if that's your context, then all of a sudden you have a very rich life. And
what is the most complicated role you've performed?
But I think what you're talking about here is listening, keeping your eyes open, your heart open. That becomes the job, doesn't it? And that's getting harder for, this artist in this climate, in this world that we live in. So I have to turn off the TV, I have to turn off the phone, the laptop, and get back to the stuff that I love, which is the arts, painting, people, spending time with people, get off the phone, talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's critical now.
I agree with you. I have to stay connected, though, to the – not the phone so much, but to the to the news, to the observation of the world we're living in.
But we were very well informed 20 years ago with a newspaper and maybe the evening news.
Oh, you love the newspaper?
Yeah. Yeah, so if I could just – and plus now we can go to – we get the New York Times, and then I can check The Guardian. Mm-hmm. I can check these things all over the planet.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't want to watch 8 hours of MSNBC every day. You know, that's the hard part for me. I mean, just for the artist.
Yeah.
And yet there were days I can sit down and turn on Hayes. Does he begin or is it Hardball?
Chris Matthews.
And four hours later...
You're still there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But see, I find that compelling too. And it's character study to me.
Oh,
you're
that's
watching,
interesting.
You're beginning to understand someone's... how they operate emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, where they are connected. Mm. And then those are all those pieces that you use to create a character. You asked me before, what's the most difficult character I've created? I don't know exactly how to answer that. I'd say that there are some that are more complex than others. The one of them that I did that brought me back to the theater in 1999, I hadn't been on stage for 22 years. I went into television, I threw myself into television. And I did a play called Wit, which won the Pulitzer Prize. It was written by a woman named Margaret Edson, who wrote one play.
Yes.
Maggie wrote one play. And everybody won the Pulitzer Prize. And everybody said to her, so what are you going to write next? She said, I only have one play in me. I want to teach kindergarten. So she and her partner, Linda, have two children, and they live in Atlanta. And she was a kindergarten teacher for a long time. Now she's teaching eighth grade. But she said, I had a friend. He needed a shed. He wanted to build a shed. He went to the, I guess, the Home Depot. He got all the supplies. He built the shed. And everybody said to him, oh, my God, that's gorgeous. What are you going to build now? And he said, I just wanted to build a shed. Yeah. And she said the same thing about the play. She said, I had one play to write. This was the play. And so I did that play. And that was a very complicated character, really fascinating. And I loved that. And I would say the last thing that I did that we're talking about
Versace.
Now is Versace. The assassination of Gianni Versace.
That was
remarkable. Really, thank you. It's a complicated, it's always a complication, and you'll know this too, Paul, playing somebody who's alive.
Yeah.
You have to be very deferential
very
careful about the way you're doing something. And so, but you know, anything that looks complicated or seems to be complicated, when you have a great writer, somebody like Tom Robb Smith, and great directors guiding you, Gwyneth Horder-Payton, and great actors, Mike Farrell, that you get to work with, that all makes the process so much easier. And then, you know, you have Ryan Murphy, who's your producer.
How about that Ryan Murphy and the amount of fabulous.
He's extraordinary. Again, goes back to vision. It's like it's the same thing with you. You have this very large, expanded vision that takes you into places that you think about it, but then you do it. Other people have
amazing.
That. I mean, you know, you have that too. I mean, you know, you've
but to
you've
follow
accomplished
through
that.
On all of them on so many fronts and have so many things out there. We talked the other day about how you had 7 shows on at one time, and we had a producer on the other day, and he had said he had
Greg Berlanti,
who I adore.
Just great.
I just saw him at a wedding.
Just so great. He's got 14 shows coming on.
He's remarkable.
But you had 3 networks. So in Norman Lear years, that's like having 28 shows on at the same time, I think, because there's so many outlets now.
Yeah.
Not that we're comparing.
No, but you, but I always like to talk about what it speaks to about that person. Mm. When you talk about Norman and all of those shows, and when you talk about Ryan and you know, you see all of those shows and he's about to go to Netflix, there is a kind
of. He's about to go to Netflix, and so is Berlanti, although the deal he just made is with Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
Oh, is that right?
They both made these
humongous
deals.
Humongous deals.
Yeah, and they each sat in this chair within the last 2 weeks.
Really?
This is true.
Oh, my God. They're just – they're amazing.
And nice people. Good, love, nice people.
Listen,
easy to talk to.
You know what? This is a small business with – a lot of people who have whatever issues they have. And when you get to work with the lovely ones, the nice ones,
the
people like Norman, it's like, what are you complaining about? Your life is so good.
Yeah.
You have so much creativity, so much talent. Why are you so unhappy? Mm. You can have great people to work with, and you know, Ryan and Greg and Norman are 3
fabulous.
Of them. They're fabulous people.
And there's nothing better than when that all comes together. It's like a family.
Oh my God.
Heaven.
It's just gorgeous.
Whether it's a show or a company and a play or it's an amazing little virtual family that comes together.
Yeah. And it can happen more than it often does happen.
What's the longest run you've had in theater?
In theater. Interesting. I think
8 performances a week.
Oh my God. Lombardi was a play that I did that was supposed to run for not very terribly long. It was the little play that could. And it was about Vince Lombardi. And we did that from
It wouldn't surprise me if Judith Light played Vince McMahon.
I did. No, my darling friend Dan Loria, who's a wonderful actor. Danny played Lombardi, and he was fabulous. We did that. We ran from September until May at Circle in the Square in New York. And that was long. And then after that, I did Other Desert Cities, written by John Robin Bates, and Joe Mantello directed it. And we ran on Broadway probably from October until after the Tonys, I think. Maybe till the end of June, middle of June, something like that. Mm. So those were two of the longest runs. And those 8 show weeks, you say,
yes.
8 shows a week, that is...
That's
a nightmare.
You know what? Do you find it so?
At a certain point.
Do you?
Yeah. Describe your career.
Well, I mean, I've done a lot of theater, and the longest I've done is 2 years. I did this play in London in the West End for a year, and then went to Broadway with it for a year. And but the thing about it is, it's when you wake up and the first thing you have to think about, how's my voice?
Yes.
And then everything you do, if you're at lunch, you're thinking about the half that you have to be at the theater.
That's right.
And that's really the heart, because what happens is...
You have no life.
You have no life.
That's right.
More so than anything else. And then whether you're sick, you go on stage and you see the people. It really is true. It sounds Pollyanna. But you go on the stage and the people are there.
Oh,
and you know that. I remember when I was a kid, I would get tickets to something and I would pin the tickets to the bulletin board in my room.
Oh.
And if I had them for six weeks, I would think, oh, here comes the date. And I'd look at them every day. And it meant so much when I finally got to go to the place.
Sweet.
And so that, you go out on the stage.
I know.
And that really does make it happen. It's all the before. And the grind and the after, you know, that really makes it a grind and makes you go like, oh, man, I have to do this again. But then Dr. Footlights, as a great British actor once said to me, I had the flu. I don't know if I can do this show tonight. And he said, Alfred Marx, his son Gareth Marx, great actor, was playing the big bopper in this show I did about Buddy Holly.
Mm-hmm.
And Alfred Marx, tonight you'll go on the stage. Dr. Footlights will take care of the rest. How could you not go on?
That's so fabulous.
It's really
I'm going to use that for forever.
Absolutely.
I mean, Dr. Footlights will
and
take care of
it. Isn't it remarkable how that part of your brain, all of a sudden you're well and then you walk off and you're just
and
sick
you just,
as a dog?
Absolutely.
Because it's the mind. It's the mental stuff that if we could use that – what you're talking about in life every single day.
Right.
To stop that programmed mind that defeats you, the world would be a different place.
That would be the ultimate. That would be the ultimate in consciousness.
But that is also what the arts can do. And what I am worried about now.
Very good point.
Is that we're slashing the funding to the arts. We are taking
arts
the arts
and humanities.
Arts and humanities. What is it that is the first thing to go? Are you kidding? There are so many young people out there. I'm on the board of directors of the MCC Theater, Manhattan Class Company in New York. We have a training program for young people. Not every kid plays basketball. Not every kid plays baseball.
Right.
These are these young people with these expanded creative talents that need support. They've got to keep the arts and humanities in the school. I just simply do not understand it.
So federal funding is totally gone.
It's gone. It's gone.
Like there's none. Zero.
No. And it continues to decline. And the NEA is in trouble. The National Endowment for the Arts is in trouble. And that's – I'm so deeply concerned about this. And as citizens, we must find our ways to challenge that and do something different in relating to it.
Why is that always under attack when there is evidence, all the evidence they need, that it should be funded? The benefits of it are huge and many.
Oh, I don't – if we save the world, and I don't want to wake up the morning I'm without hope, so I know we will.
Right.
But it'll be the arts and humanities that pulled us through or kicked open the door.
No question. No question. But until we start speaking to it, like we're talking about it right now, and there'll be somebody out there who will say, you know what? I want to do that in my community. I'm going to start relating differently to that in my community. And when people – get themselves together and create that, it makes all the difference in the world. You can create a difference. I agree with you about hope. We have to have hope. I mean, you know, Anne Frank was our beacon of that. I still believe at heart that people are really good at heart. I mean, there is that light that lives in all of us, and I think we can do it. I do.
I have to believe we can and will.
I know, and I think we do, and I think there are places.
But you have to have had in your career as many roles as you played. You have to have done already have kicked that tire along the road, or however best to put it, working in plays that were so informative and led an audience to believe where there's a will, there's a way, there's a rainbow at the end of the yeah. all of those things.
I like to think so. I like to.
What role comes to mind in what piece?
One of them is definitely Wit, which was Maggie Edson's play, because it was about a person who lived one way, very stalwart, very closed off, very mindful of language and literature, and this was the way to get through life. And she's dying of fourth stage ovarian cancer, and she comes to realize that that's not what's important. What's important is that we need people. We need to relate to other people in ways that are supportive and valuable. We're only here, I think, to expand our own consciousness and to be the support to help other people expand their consciousness. That's what I think we're here to do. Mm-hmm. And so in that play, that's what that was about. And even though the character dies at the end, there was a transformation of her in that process, that as she is in her process of dying, she becomes a different person.
Yeah.
And so...
That's kind of stunning, and what a good thing to leave an audience to walk out after seeing that.
Yeah, and so when I would finish, and you know, I had gone through the process and finished the play, and people would come back afterwards and go, "Oh my God, I'm devastated. I don't know what to do with myself." And people were deeply moved by it, and it was interesting because I was done. I had completed the journey, and I was like, "Let's go eat. Let's
go. Right.
Let's go." But it was important to be there with the audience as they had that experience, as what they were left with. And people to this day come up and talk to me about it. People to this day come up. Young women come up to me to this day to say that who's the boss? Because people didn't realize at the time what a cultural shift it was, that the woman was in the workforce and that she had a male housekeeper at home. And young women come up to me to this day and say to me, "Oh, I am working in advertising because I saw your character do that." So there are things that you would think may not be of an order of the highest order, like a play like Wit, but you see it in Who's the Boss. So I've had that all through my career, where people have come and said that changed me, that I reflected on that, it mattered to me.
Yeah, now, that's satisfying.
And how do we help people understand that everybody listening to us and everybody they know has the capability, not just the capability, but in the course of their days, they are certainly going to move something in some direction. They're going to provide some individual with a better moment.
There is no
question.
With
a better day. And not even understand that they've done it.
Mm. Right.
And I love this. I love trying to understand the size and scope of the designer's design here, this planet, this world, a planet among perhaps a million planets in a universe of which there could be millions. I mean, it's impossible to get your mind around it. But what it suggests to me is you help somebody smile, you provide somebody with a moment, in the great scheme of things, taking all of the size and scope in through the centuries, and you cannot, if you wanted to imagine the difference in the impact between that and something, the design of the Ford or the impact of Jonas Salk. That little thing you did to help somebody smile compared to what Jonas Salk did, it's the same thing.
It's exactly the same thing. And I'm so glad you're saying this, because it is that way of thinking that cuts through. It's what I call crossing the transaction that Eric Byrne used to talk about in transactional analysis, that you cross the transaction of the mind that says, I'm just a little person. I can't do anything. Mm. I can't make a difference. And so then you go through your life never realizing that you have the capability to make that difference.
Yeah.
And have made that difference without knowing it.
And exactly. You remember Buckminster Fuller?
Oh, yes.
Bucky, his whole life, he dedicated his life to proving what the little individual could do. That's what he said he would set about to do in his life. And that's what he created monumental other things like the geodesic dome for one. And, I think it was the first electric car. But he was devoted to knowing what you just spoke to, Norman, that when people are busy of their day and they have four kids and two jobs and no time for themselves and they don't remember that they have changed someone's life in a major way. Mm-hmm. It's the movie It's a Wonderful Life.
Yes.
Yes, it's that's why that movie I think is so impactful. But I think the reminder of that is so essential.
What I need to know is, did they really call him Bucky?
Yeah.
Yes.
I love that.
Oh, yeah. We called him.
I never heard that.
Yeah. I mean, people who were close to him called him Bucky. There's a one-person show that somebody does about him, and it's quite wonderful. He was very extraordinary.
Yeah, no, I've been in classrooms where they talked about Buckminster Fuller, but Bucky.
Yeah. And then he created this thing called Buckyballs. There are these there's some sort of molecule, and they're called Buckyballs. He identified them, something like that. So anyway, we don't have to expand on that.
Yeah, I have this material. We're not going to go.
But
you know what I loved about the Kunan, the assassination of Johnny Versace, the role you did in that. What a rich character that was, because she's not easy. She's not an easy hang, that lady.
No.
And what is her name?
Marilyn Miglin.
Yeah. But through it, because of the way that you layered that, her humanity is always there. There's always something there that we can identify with.
Thanks.
In that last episode, when the cops show up, she doesn't give an inch. I was waiting for her to even just give an inch. She never gives an inch. How do you play that scene and not give an inch, yet let her humanity through? Do you know what I mean? Because a lesser actor, it could have been one, I will play the surface meaning of the text, just angry at the cops. But we could see her, the kindness. We could see what we find out later, what I won't tell the audience because they should watch it. But she reveals something of herself later on. I could see it in that scene before you did it. That's fascinating.
Thank you.
Yeah, that is like, how do you find that?
No human being is one note. We are a multitude of people that live inside of us, I think. We are majestic and magnificent and multi-leveled. What drives us are psychological dynamics. And when it's my job, I think, and my responsibility to dig deep, to find those places. And when you have a great writer, like I said, in Tom Rob Smith, and you have great producers and great hair, makeup, and wardrobe people helping you create somebody, you never do it alone. There are things that, for me, they're tactile for me. I begin to understand them in a way that when I'm looking at the script or dissecting it, it's like a treasure map. That there are these places that I can go that lead me to express everything that's going on. I mean, we're all sitting here together, and there are a million things that go on in all of us all the time. And so our psychology, I think, in some ways really drives it. And so you just have to dig for that and create all of that in that moment.
For you, who may have turned in after we started, and for everybody that's listening, that was Judith Light talking about Judith Light.
Dropping an acting clinic.
And it was glorious.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And we're not going to top that. We're going to close this session with Judith Light.
Well, can I just say,
Judith Light.
If you're listening.
And I was so blown away by that.
Yeah. Thanks. If you're listening, send this to the young actor in your life or young actress in your life, because they need to hear this. Or the old actor in your life. Anybody, any actor. That was fantastic.
Thanks.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you for asking.
This
truly
has been all of the above in the way in which Judith Light was talking about acting. It was all of the above. Thank you all. Bless you, Judith.
Bless you, Norman.
Bless you,
Paul. Thank you, Judith.
Love you.
What does it mean, this life, this day and night?
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at TheNormanLear.
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Vian.
And life is good. And space and time, give me some of yours, I'll give you some of mine.
New every Tuesday to Podcast One, Shenanigans with Sheena Shea from Vanderpump Rules.
I'm very happy in Vegas, and I know I say I'm happy. I always say that people don't even believe me anymore. But
you're like the girl who cried happy instead of the boy who cried wolf.
To hear more Shenanigans with Sheena Shea, subscribe exclusively on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and the new Podcast One app. Don't forget to rate, review, and leave a 5-star rating.